It strikes me that this impasse is here to stay. I'm talking here of the U.S., Iran, but that incorporates, I think, that whole theater, and maybe arguably Ukraine as well, although it's, you know, apples and oranges. There's some overlap, especially chronologically over the last 10 years and so on, and especially in the last 3 years. At this point, I mean, there's no tackle to talk about this week because there was no build-up on Trump's behalf in the U.S. end. He didn't bother.
Mm-hmm.
They skipped it this week. That shit might come back. But excluding all the MOU and the tackling and so on, the de facto reality is that since April 8th, the war has essentially ended. There have been big exchanges of fire since then, I know, but that was it. So that's now most of April, May, June, July, and we're into August. It really does suggest it's a new reality, and everyone's having to adapt to it, not least the Americans. This is a shocker for them, but here it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go with that assumption, at least for this week, because who knows what happens next week,
mm-hmm.
but going with that assumption, what other kinds of things can we expect going forward?
The potential fly in the ointment is obviously Israel.
Israel too. There's rumors that they're, you know, they said that they reserve the right to go at Iran alone.
Mm-hmm.
But that's big talk, because can they really? Unless they do something with the nuke. But then at that point, you know, you're in the mad zone anyway. So mm-hmm. all bets are off. But
yeah, I don't think they're not going to use a nuke. They won't be allowed to use a nuke or whatever.
Yeah.
They probably would dream of doing it, or they've dreamed of doing it for a long time, but it's just, it's not, and it wouldn't even necessarily be effective. You're not talking about some kind of, you know, strategic nuclear weapon, right? You're not talking about something of serious power. You'd be talking about some kind of, because obviously it would, you know, would be serious problems for the entire region, right? Nuclear fallout and all that kind of stuff. So they can't go typical Cold War nuke type thing, so it'd have to be some kind of tactical nuke or something like that. But even then, so that would be relatively low yield or whatever. But it wouldn't deal with the problem, you know.
No, Iran's too.
Iran would still just keep firing missiles at them, yeah, regardless of whether or not they got tactically nuked.
Yeah.
So yeah, none of that. But and what can Israel do? Yeah, what, some more attempted decapitation strikes, take out their leaders or something like that.
Do
more leader taking out and stuff. None of it. Yeah, the whole thing just the whole thing stinks of a kind of a setup in a certain sense, you know. When I look at the whole thing over the past 4 or 5 months, there's an ulterior motive behind all of this, it seems to me anyway. And the ulterior motive we may see manifesting within a number of months, let's say, and obviously it's the economic impact. The only thing that really stands out from all of this is the potential economic impact on the entire world because of where the actual conflict was started and where it's been happening, and the implications for oil and gas out of the Strait of Hormuz and stuff. So, and that has yet to be felt, strangely, as well.
We talked about that last week. Strange.
Well, we talked about that last week, though, but China had been drawing down on its reducing its refining and drawing down on some of its strategic reserves in order to bolster to insulate the global economy from oil and gas shortage, right? So it basically cut back on imports. So that explains, I suppose, to some extent. There's also talk about the UAE being back already at pre-war
levels.
Capacity through that Fujairah pipeline, which is basically goes from the UAE across eastwards over just to below the Strait of Hormuz, basically, and they've been shipping a couple of million barrels a day or something like that. Still, if most of the rest of it is missing, you're still at a significant shortfall. Meanwhile, Iran is obviously doubled down, playing hardball, playing kind of ridiculously hardball, to be honest. But what's the agenda behind that? Because that would, you know, suggest, I suppose, that, I mean, their list of, from the National Security Council, their list of demands, basically, is more or less like the MOU, right? Correcting, until America corrects its behavior, the Strait of Hormuz will not be opened. Right, so this is, it's in Iran's hands, basically. Iran is the one that is keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed right now, because maybe not officially, but the US has more or less mothballed its blockade. It's not really blockading anything right now. So it's Iran that's stopping a certain amount of flow out of the Strait of Hormuz by preventing non-friendly tankers belonging to or associated with or delivering to or receiving for non-friendly countries. They don't get to pass, and if they try and pass, they get misheld. So they say that until America corrects its behavior, the Strait of Hormuz will not be opened. And correcting behavior means never threaten Iran again with any language or insult. With any language nor insult the sanctity of this nation. End the war on aggression against Iran and its allies in Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen, and Iraq permanently. It's a big ask.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Palestine for the Israelis. But that's obviously, the Americans are meant to put pressure on, somehow put pressure on Israel to stop genocide in Palestinians. Lift the naval blockade and withdraw U.S. naval air forces. Like I said, the naval blockade, is there really anything happening with the naval blockade? Who knows? I don't think so. It hasn't done much, to be honest, since it was supposedly introduced. And so lift the naval blockade and withdraw U.S. naval forces and air forces from around the area. Pay damages for two aggressive wars imposed against Iran, not just this one, but last year's one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lift the cruel and illegal sanctions against the Iranian nation and release frozen and stolen assets of the Iranian people unconditionally.
Wow. Which is many, many billions of dollars worth.
Yeah, that's Trump's. That could be seen as Trump's, aim big type thing, you know.
Yeah, people are saying Iran's doing art of the deal.
Right? Yeah, that's Trump's art of the deal, right?
Aim super high.
Because to get all that, it's almost, if you were to suggest that they're not going to
budge unless all of that is.
Yeah, then that just means that they're deliberately making it impossible for
Trump.
For the Strait of Hormuz to be opened, right?
Yeah,
they're willing to apply more pressure to the global economy. So yeah, it's not just on America; it's obviously on the global economy and all that kind of stuff, and trying to have pressure put on Trump via other countries to give Iran what it wants. So they're playing a game. Obviously, it's unknown. You know what? They don't know exactly what the US will be willing to do, or what it can do, let's say, but they want to get as much as possible. Those list of demands should be taken, you know, to some extent with a grain of salt, in the sense that they're not necessarily what Iran isn't going to die on that particular hill of all of those, right? Certain points in that plan are maybe more important than others. Yeah.
There's another one they floated this week, although I think it's moot, but it speaks to going massive in their demands, raising their 1 or 2% fee rate on per barrel of oil to 5 to 7%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that's ridiculous. Yeah.
Up we go. It's still lower than Trump's 20, but
yeah, well, Trump was never serious about any of that. Like, but yeah, I think it's like in other countries too, going through different shipping channels and stuff, countries that control them or operate the facilities that are asked for, but it's usually like 0.5% or something like that, 0.5 or 0.23 or 0.4, something like that, something significantly below 1% of the value of the cargo. So 7% is just like, meh. Don't think so.
They like the status quo.
No, they probably, well, maybe, assuming the US can't enforce an embargo or a blockade against Iran, you know what I mean?
That they can inflict more pain.
But the problem is that would require some kind of kinetic action that Iran would interpret as the war's continuing, and therefore if America were to do that, they risk, that's the problem. That's why they basically were able to mothball America's blockade to a large extent, or make it ineffective, because for the US to effectively police its blockade, it would have to take direct action, possibly kinetic like missiles, whatever, at an attack ships, Iranian ships, and that would be seen by Iran as, well, then it would start a spiral of violence basically again, which then could escalate into Trump trying to take out their civilization or some bullshit, whatever, and then Iran doing their doomsday scenario, which is basically take out all the Gulf refineries. And you have all the Gulf countries all obviously lobbying the US to, you know, against this, you know, against going that far. So, and probably most of the rest of the world, you know, they're all watching with trepidation. But, yeah. So, and the other element that came out this week was the Turks, Pakistanis, and the Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called? The Sauterpak Alliance. Sauterpak. Sauterpak.
I don't know what they're going. I've heard it. The Islamic NATO.
Tersopak. Pasauter. Whatever. The Islamic NATO,
The Sunni Pact.
The Sunni Pact, yeah. That's obviously just, you know, it obviously comes on the heels of, well, what it points to is them all realizing that, I mean, let's say you have to give it some time to see if it actually goes anywhere, this alleged alliance. If it goes anywhere, then it, and if it, you know, if it takes hold and actually manifests into something, you know, concrete, then it will be evidence that they're all anticipating the US not really being able to play the kind of role it played in the Middle East anymore. And that's a problem, you know.
Yeah.
Because things can just go, things can just all fall apart, basically, you know what I mean, for America. Like we've talked before about the petrodollar and the American is being the world's policeman, all that kind of stuff. And if it fails here in the Middle East, which it obviously has already under Trump, then it's gonna, that's the main pillar under, you know, taken away out from underneath America's kind of global policeman status, you know what I mean? And it would fall quite quickly after that. And America doesn't seem to be interested in doing anything, but at least Trump doesn't seem to be interested in doing anything about it. And there's all sorts of, you know, potential, like I'm not saying right now, but potential negative repercussions for the US, obviously, as global hegemon, and then the American dollar and the economy in general. It's very, very, it has all sorts of potential implications for the whole world, basically. A remaking of the world, a new world order, as we've titled the show. Just not the kind of new world order that people have heard about before now. And in fact, a new world order that nobody really can put flesh on yet, you know.
Yeah.
Flesh out.
Well, the new world order of conspiracy lore was that it would be a kind of anonymous, in a sense, faceless, somewhere central, maybe not physically central, but institutionally central body with different layers to it, world currency, world religion, world government, etc. And as a placeholder, because there's nowhere else to point to centrally, the Birch Society in the 60s in the US, and then the more recent incarnation is Alex Jones, of course, in the 2000s. That was the UN. Or adjunct institution.
We can throw in any number. Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg Group, right. All that kind of stuff.
You know, reality, though, the geopolitical reality all this time is that really meant the U.S. It was the U.S.
World order.
Century, the American century after World War II.
Right, but the question is, who's behind that? I mean, this is where you get into, again, kind of deeper conspiracy theory. It's like, who's running the U.S.? Who actually controls the U.S.? You've got, you know, in recent years, especially since Trump came around. You've had the popularization of the term deep state, and people just throw that term around and stuff, but they, you know, they don't really, I don't think they really understand the implications of what they're saying when they say deep state. You know what I mean? You're talking about non-elected bureaucracy that has been running the US's domestic and foreign policy, not overtly, but covertly, and interceding at time whenever it's needed to push, keep it all in a certain direction.
And that may not even be American.
Yeah, well, who knows?
Recognizably American.
Well, deep state, whatever, yeah. Could be from anywhere in a certain sense, but obviously they'd have to have connections. They're globalists. That's where you get back to the term globalist.
Yeah.
And these are people who are unelected and have been running US, you know, the important aspects of US foreign policy and domestic policy for forever. For 100 years, 200 years, I don't know how long. So that's the globalists. For want of a better word, is the deep state, but then it's not just centered in America. Maybe that's their home base in America, but they obviously have fingers in pies all around the world. And maybe it's these, maybe it's them that are behind all of this. Maybe it's them that's orchestrating this situation in the Middle East. Maybe it's them that have planned and are in the process right now, as we've been watching it happen, of instituting a new world order that involves the changing of the guard, basically, and maybe ushering in some kind of global economic crisis or whatever, in order to usher in a new world order, the new world order that Alex Jones has been talking about for so long. So it's the new world order is in the process of manifesting.
Yeah.
How, well, actually, obviously, when Alex Jones had talked about it in the past, you know, in broad strokes, got it right. Globalist control, you know, I don't know, surveillance, herding of the population, global population, to a finer order of control.
A prison planet,
there you go, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it could, that could be it. We don't know, but that could be it. But certainly you need in order to do that, you need some kind of major crisis. And it's not even, but it doesn't really make any sense, because the kind of crisis you would need in order to usher in that kind of a global police state to that extent would almost by necessity mean that you don't really have a properly or a well-organized, you know, global social order anymore. Because the crisis that you institute in order to institute your control, your mm-hmm. police state, would run the serious risk of bringing down the entire global social order. Not all at once, obviously, but in different places or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you don't have control anymore, you know? It's almost like, you know, there's these people that I control, but I don't control them enough because they live relatively freely in a relatively free society. I want to control them more, so I don't know. Let's take away all their food. They're all going to starve and die, and then you won't have anybody to control. Like, you know what I mean? Or let's impoverish them. But then, I mean,
also bread riots are notoriously difficult to control.
Yeah. So it's like, do you want to control a slave population? Or because it seems that the appeal has always been to be able to control people while they still believe that they're free.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't take away their freedom and convince them they're still free.
It only works if it's...
I mean, you can do that to a certain extent, but it's little bits here and there, like COVID, here, you know.
You have to bring their free will along. If you shock them and then their free will is...
Yeah, but
disrupted.
if you keep going to finer and finer orders of control, you can't avoid destroying the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What's the end goal of that? Put them all in prison. We don't need to control them anymore and they're all in prison. But you've lost the most important aspect of that, apparently, of that control, which is their compliance. Because when you put them in prison, they realize that they're in prison and they don't like you anymore. And they don't go, thank you for putting us in prison. Can we have some more prison, please? It doesn't extend that far.
Yeah.
You can get them to say, thank you for making a vaccine. Can we have another vaccine, please?
They did do that.
Until it starts to become apparent that it wasn't a good idea. And then what are you going to do? Well, we have to do more. We have to do worse. And so it's like, yeah, it just doesn't have an obvious logical outcome. You know, it doesn't have a rational outcome where you get the kind of control that you want while still having the society under which people live that was, you know, where they were free. But the thing that annoys you is the freedom that they have. The still remaining freedoms that they have is the thing that annoys you. So you want to take those freedoms away without people being aware that their freedoms are being taken away. And you want to take it away to the nth degree so that they end up effectively completely enslaved, but still happy about it. I don't think it works that way. Yeah. Human beings are malleable and, you know, foolable, but only to a certain, to a significant degree, but not to a ridiculous degree.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a rational, logical.
There are bandwidth limits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The earlier models of the coming new world order, they missed something because it surprised everyone. Even though it was first, the term was first used in academic papers in Moscow and Beijing in the 90s, the first time anyone really heard multipolarity was circa 2012, 2013. And then they didn't pay attention to it, but they did once the shit kicked off in Ukraine and it entered the common discourse when trying to understand world events and current events. So they never modeled in, okay, so what it's all problem, reaction, solution, and the globalists are always in control, right? So what will happen is the US will be doing awesome. It'll be at a full spectrum dominance. It'll be going for total information awareness and it'll be right there and about to do it. But then, lo and behold, watch this. There's going to be near peer competitors who come and appear to disrupt it. But that's only to fool everyone. No, you've gone too far. That strikes me as an actually genuine and real disruption. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you don't still have entrenched interests who can adapt to it, and they are trying to. That came out of left field, even for the basic model of where the globalists wanted to take us 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we can still go there, but they're having to adapt against usurpers.
Yeah, pushback. Yeah.
They are genuinely usurpers. They see Putin as a radical, basically like a Lenin, even though he's not of the left ideological persuasion. He's come along and he's disrupted the plans here, big time. Same with China. They hate that China modernized, but not in Western, along Western lines. Mm-hmm. It's done its own thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So problem, reaction, solution, that as a theoretical model, a Hegelian dialect, right? That itself broke down because there were now competing idea centers to the original plan when there was a unipolar world. That doesn't mean it still can't work, but it's unlikely to. This is what we're opening the show about, that it's a new world order, but it's not what they thought it would be. It will have to, the globalists will have to adapt like everyone else. So, for example, while it's oil and energy that's key in America's fight with Iran, and while it's kind of moot at this point whether Trump did it for Israel or for the U.S., to retain a marginal controlling interest in how the global energy spigot, the Middle East, was distributed, to keep back Iranian, especially Chinese and Russian influence in that distribution of energy and how much they would have access to. Where was I going to go with that? I've lost my train of thought.
The problem is that I've said this the past few weeks, whatever, and you could look at this as basically the US. If you want to understand why Trump, people are like, why is Trump doing what he did and all that kind of stuff? Why it was so stupid, it was such a bad idea from the beginning. Well, like we talked about last week or the week before, whatever, a quote from the one of the major, the I think the biggest refinery in the US on the Gulf Coast in Texas, guy saying that he was asked, the manager was asked, how's it been since, how's this affected your business and stuff. He said, like, since this Iran business, the attack in Iran, I've basically seen an unending supply of, an unending passage of ships coming past my window every day.
Yes.
Businesses through the roof, basically because, which is obvious, right? Because you cut off the Strait of Hormuz and a lot of people are now coming to the US for oil and gas.
Down in Corpus Christi.
Yeah. So he, point being, he, you could look at that and go, well, that right there is a reason or an answer to the question of why did Trump do what? Why did Trump start this business with Iran? To make money, to get oil, to get people coming to America to buy American oil and gas. Why did they blow up Nord Stream? To get Europeans dependent on, or more dependent on American, or to get a share of Russia's gas for America. I mean, you don't have to go any further than that, like, if you want a simple answer, like, and it's a very compelling answer. There you go. That's why they did it, you know.
Yes.
But obviously that would be in the context, if you want to put it in broader geopolitical context, you would say that this is, and we've talked about this ad nauseum over the past few years, of changing world order, versioning multipolarity, China, Russia on the rise, basically going to, you know, unseat America as a global hegemon and usher in a multipolar world. And in that context, America has a lot to lose because, you know, you come from being the top dog and suddenly you're not the top dog anymore. You have to take a cut in your wages, basically. And it could be deadly. It could be fatal. The cut, potentially, they don't know how it would manifest, but Americans looking at it would say, look, this could be actually fatal for the American economy because we're used to, I mean, I use the example of a big fat man basically getting a certain amount of food every day.
Yeah.
He gets lots of Coke and lots of Twinkies and lots of hamburgers and all that kind of stuff, and he needs that to maintain his position on his size, and then he has to take a cut. Well, I mean, it could be fatal to him. Depending on how much you cut his food off, it could actually be fatal because his system has been conditioned to survive on this amount of food every day. Okay, it's not a perfect analogy because obviously people can go on a diet and survive, but some systems can't. So America could have started all this, or this could be part of America's response to something they've seen coming a long time ago, or were concerned about that it was coming quite a long time ago, pre-9/11 to be exact, because of the Project for a New American Century. It was right there in the neocons document, the Project for a New American Century. America risks losing its position as a global hegemon unless it can reassert its influence and dominance around the world, particularly in the Middle East, and that they were advocating, this is in the late 1990s, advocating redeploying American forces in earnest into the Middle East and elsewhere around the world. And they said that they wouldn't be able to do that, though, because, you know, it was after the end of the Cold War, America had won. There was no reason to go and start another global war or another Cold War or whatever. And that they would need some kind of, catalyzing event, or like a new Pearl Harbor. And then they got that a couple of years later after they'd written that, or less than a couple of years later, in the form of 9/11, which then justified the war on terror, which was obviously a euphemism for America projecting its military forces around the world, but particularly into the Middle East as that strategic area. And this is, and we're now at a culmination of that whole project, right? There's been fits and starts up and down and all kinds of stuff, but that has really, since 9/11, there is a continuum from 9/11 until today in terms of how the world has changed. 9/11 signaled a renewal of a Cold War, basically, just very shortly, less than 10 years after the old one had finished,
we need a Cold War.
We need it, and we need to keep it going. So let's start a new one. Let's call it the War on Terror. So yeah, this could be the culmination of that pushback by the American powers that be, policymakers, bureaucrats, etc.
Yes.
This is maybe not the culmination, but certainly after 25 years, it's a continuing part of that initial decision to push back against the threat of a multipolar world. I mean, it hasn't stopped. It hasn't stopped the rise of Russia and China, but certainly they've bogged Russia down in a war in Ukraine. China was always had to keep China on board in a certain sense to keep them happy because they're the world's supplier of cheap plastic crap and expensive plastic crap and all sorts of other crap. But you deal with them economically, right? And you keep, you know, you game out the, you know, Taiwan and Malacca Straits and all kinds of stuff, but that's not going to happen. But
what you said there is a hell of a strategic vision, 10 and 20 and even 30 years into the future. I mean, it might look prosaic to us now.
Yeah, but they weren't
because at the time, there's no, like, Russia and Russia in the late 90s it was really on the racks all the way up to really 2004.
Yeah, but you didn't have to be super smart to realize that a country of that size, of that landmass, with those kind of resources, unless you're able to actually subvert it and take it over and regime change it yourself from within, then that country is going to, over the next X number of years, it doesn't take... You don't have to be a super brain to kind of game it out that country is going to naturally, right? They're looking at natural forces here. You know, look at natural population size, resource size, land size, and say that country in 10 or 20 years, whatever, is going to be, you know, if left to its own devices, it's obviously going to become a powerful player in the world. China as well, given its population size primarily and its strategic position in Eurasia, it was going to be another one. If those two countries got together, then, I mean, it goes back to Halford Mackinder and the Heartland and all that kind of stuff, you know. So it's not, it's 100 years old, this geopolitical theory, basically, you know what I mean? The geopolitical theory that's been played out of that they've been following is literally 100 years old. It hasn't changed in 100 years or more. So we're just seeing the details of how it's manifesting for us now in the current time, in the current climate, with the current, you know, social situation on the planet. The even you could bring in climate, you could bring in and obviously bring in specific politicians like Trump or different individuals, who Trump being probably the most important one, because he was president of America, and also because of his nature, because he wasn't just another polished, you know, dyed-in-the-wool politician who was just going to do whatever the bureaucrats or deep staters or whatever wanted. There does seem to be hard evidence that, I mean, you have to be very cynical or very conspiratorial to think that Trump is part of it all. Or that, because, I mean, they fought against him in 2016. They tried to impeach him multiple times through the mechanisms that they have, overtly impeachment and all kinds of the DOJ and the Democrat National Committee and the Democrat establishment are basically behind the scenes. They obviously tried to get rid, didn't want him there. So to think that Trump has been brought in to, but that doesn't, these people, like you, kind of like you were saying, that they work on the fly, if you know what I mean. They respond to situations as they arise. It's not like there's some long-term conspiratorial plan, let's say, that is set in stone from the day that it was conceived of, and then it's followed every step of the way. No. Without, because obviously there's changing dynamics.
Some elements are.
Well, no.
Projecting as much as they could into Central Asia, using a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. No. Saying that in the 90s and then going, right, it's happened, into Afghanistan, into Iraq.
Yeah.
Shut down. There's no pipelines being built. There's no roads being built. There's no integrated railway systems happening. Good. But that only lasts so long. But no, anyway, point is simply that there are elements that they have fairly impressive vision for going ahead. But the rest, they're definitely
what I'm saying is the details don't plan out. It's not planned out in the specific details.
No.
Of course, you have a vision. And they had their vision, which I described a new American century, controlling America, maintaining America's hegemony and America's influence and control in the world as it has been into the 21st century, the American century. And their general idea was, we've got to use our military to project that power in order to control our position or maintain our position as global hegemon and keep all the usurpers down. How that actually plays out and whether or not it's successful in the details and what kind of twists and turns along the way, of course, they don't know.
Yeah.
But they follow it as best they can. They go back to their original plan all the time. When they meet a roadblock or when they meet some kind of a challenge, they on the fly decide to, we'll do this. But they're not changing their plan. They're just adjusting to the current situation in order to achieve their plan. Their goals that they set out 25 years ago, they want to continue to achieve those goals.
Yeah.
So like when you know, they thought they would just be able to coup Ukraine, put in a Western-aligned government in Ukraine, have that new government cancel the contract that Russia had for the Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol and screw over Russia that way in a big way militarily, denying it access to the Mediterranean. They do that and they see what Russia does. And Russia comes in and takes Crimea. And then they go, okay, well, next plan. Okay, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to have a war with Russia. And we planned that to some extent. Maybe that was plan B. But we're going to embroil Russia in a war with Ukraine because it's taken the bait in a certain sense. I said, look, I'm going to take your stuff. But when you try and stop me from taking your stuff and you'll be successful in stopping me from taking that stuff, I will then have caught you red-handed in trying to take my stuff or trying to stop me from taking my stuff. And you'll be caught up in a situation that I'd be able to shape the narrative to make it look like you're the aggressor, basically.
Yeah.
Like I try to take your stuff. I you know, try to steal your house or something. And you see me coming, get up in your window and you start shooting out your window at me. And you stop me, you keep me back. But I've got video evidence.
And cameras, you, and the media is all around already.
Of you in an unprovoked fashion shooting at me.
Yeah.
At me, the poor victim. And therefore, I now have to defend myself against you. And now you're in a war.
Yeah.
So they adjust along the way, right? Because of course, if Russia had just backed down and just, you know, rolled over after the 2014 coup in Ukraine and the attempt to take Crimea and the Black Sea Fleet base away from Russia, if they had just rolled over, they would have been happy. They wouldn't have done. They may not have even. They would have used the Ukrainian military as it had been built up then and since then, up to then and since then, to NATO standards. They would have used it to harass Russia and to keep them under control, but there probably wouldn't have been a war in Ukraine.
Yeah. Although they all, we know from their own memos that throughout, they knew that Ukraine was always a red line for Russia.
Yeah.
So knowing that you...
Yeah, but they don't
know. You act anyway.
It's definitely a red line for Russia, but what are they going to do when it comes down to it? You know, you can have a red line. You say, don't you step across this line. You can say it all you want. But whether or not you're serious about it is only shown when I step across the line. And if I step across the line and I find out that your words were just talk, you just blow hard. You just, don't you dare do that. And then I do it and you go, meh, whatever. Don't step on this. Don't go across this line. I'm going to move my line backwards and don't go across this line. So they don't know.
Well, they do have, they do now. They found out, right?
Well, yeah, but they obviously budgeted for that. But the point is, it's one or the other. They don't know until they try, but they keep trying. But anyway, that's in the context of them trying to, like I said, keep Russia
contained.
Yeah, and keep them bogged down. I mean, it worked out pretty perfectly. It was that Russia was going to roll over in the face of their aggression and their demands that Russia basically be a compliant state, you know, a vassal state to some extent. Or... if it didn't, then it's war.
It's war,
and you're bogged down in war, and then you can't act as freely in other places, particularly in the Middle East, for example, into which we have projected our military forces, Middle East, Southeastern Asia, whatever, to the Western Asia, as per the PNAC document and the war on terror, blah blah blah. So. That's the place where we saw as strategically important for going forward into the 21st century for American hegemony. And we wanted to make sure Russia, with its military capabilities, was focused elsewhere.
Yeah.
Which worked to some extent. Not to the extent that they would like, obviously, because Russia did involve itself in Syria. And actually, even though Syria, quote unquote, fell, with Assad having to flee and it being taken over by the Julani ISIS Al-Qaeda dude, Russia and Syria have recently signed a memorandum on the Hemenim and the TARDIS bases, according to Syrian news reports, that the Russian base will be converted into joint Syrian-Russian military training and instruction centres.
Right.
And Syria's foreign ministry said conversion must be completed within 3 months of the memorandum signing. So again, that's also the Middle East, obviously, Syria, and it's, you know, that, you know, goes along with the idea of America being, quote unquote, kicked out of the Middle East.
And it speaks to, increasingly perhaps, what you wish not coming true. You know, you think, okay, good, Assad's gone. Okay, so Russians are out now. Russians, you just exit stage left and it'll be a clear path for us to attack Iran. The second part was partly true, but that war is stymied for other structural reasons and Russia's still there in Syria.
Yeah. Well, Russia's going to, you know, fill that vacuum, basically.
Yeah.
And the fact that they've signed this, I mean, it could have been a while in the making, whatever, but the fact that it's going ahead suggests there is some level of a kind of vacuum, because as much as, you know, taking care of Syria, getting rid of Assad was for Israel's security, because obviously Syria aligned with Iran was, you know, shipping using Syria to ship weapons to Hezbollah and stuff. It was also part of America's, you know, American Israeli interests. It's hard to separate the two in that sense. And the Americans have for quite a long time wanted rid of Assad as well. Now, was that just always for Israel, or was it out of, was American, genuine American interests in terms of their control of the Middle East? Probably a bit of both. But in the same way, when they had the coup in Ukraine, and the point of that was to deny Russia access to Crimea, getting rid of Syria might have been to deny Russia access to their military, to their air and naval base in Syria. But that doesn't seem to have happened. Russia just had to wait a little while, let things play out, and then it's back to the way it was before. But in conditions that are much worse for America and Israel, to be honest. So, yeah, the big question is, it's all gone wrong for, it has all gone wrong. It seems to be all going wrong for America, assuming you don't go too far into conspiracy theory and think that it's all part of a big scheme and they're all in it together. But it's gone wrong for America and Israel in the Middle East, and it may go further wrong. But it's hard to know. It's hard to know. Like I said, they change when they take action and something doesn't go the way they want it. They adjust their perspective. And there's definitely a possibility that at this point that Trump is toying with the idea of letting the whole thing fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
That he's not going to give in to Iran's demands, and Iran will therefore keep the Strait of Hormuz closed to X numbers of ships, certain ships from certain, you know, aligned with certain countries, non-aligned, non-Iran-aligned or enemy countries, whatever. Tankers and cargo vessels will not be allowed in from those associated with those countries, i.e. America, Israel, frickin' most of Europe, whatever. And that means that there will be a continue ongoing for the next X number of months, a continued restriction on in the flow of oil and gas out of the Middle East. And at some point, like we mentioned last week, the reason that hasn't had a direct effect on oil prices in particular, there hasn't been $200 a barrel oil yet. There's no major shortages around the world, as we mentioned, because of China's actions, but China can only sustain that for so long, and there's evidence like that it's already starting to go back to its to start purchasing again at previous levels, and that may be the point at which it will things will start to really show the real deficit that has been created in the oil and gas outflows from the Middle East over the past number of months. And if they continue for the next few months, then in the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, whatever, at some point there you're going to see it's actually going to come home. The chickens are going to come home to roost, in the sense of it's going to have real world effects where people are actually going to, because you can't stop oil coming out of 20% of the world's oil and gas coming out of the Middle East and have no one go short.
And everything's the
have
same.
No one go short. No. You know, if you've got a table for six people,
and you take
six people, and everybody gets fed six plates every day, every night for dinner, and you take one away,
they're going
you
to
only serve five the next day. But the next day you look, and everybody, all six people are eating. That's because somebody shared theirs and filled the plate from the five.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But people are going to start complaining. There's going to be some hungry bellies eventually, you know what I mean, if that continues, because that reduction will increase, you know, it'll be less and less and less as time goes on each plate. And then eventually people are, I'm hungry, I'm angry. And
I remember where I was going to go, the dollar.
Mm.
Would you agree? We're talking about stuffs, the level of commodities, oil and gas and energy, It's hard to say which of the two is more important, the dollar as is, the dollar system, or that. But the two are sort of two sides of the same coin, right? So you said, you know, we should keep in mind it's possible that Trump's like, meh. And
at this point,
he's throwing caution to the wind. And whatever, the ships are flowing into Corpus Christi. We're at maximum refining capacity in the US. In fact, our producers are complaining they're over, mm-hmm. they're overstressed. They can't do anymore. But the constant that underpins and syncs it all together is the dollar as global reserve currency. Yeah. And this is where I wonder, you mentioned which country, someone we might see, one that has to go hungry first. I think of Japan, 90% plus dependent on energy from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
There are smaller countries that have a similar ratio, but Japan is 250 million people. That's a huge dependency for such an at-scale country.
Yep.
Well, there was a recent financial issue with the yen. The yen started plummeting against the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And Bessin stepped in and said, I don't like this. And effectively, they did a bailout. Yen, yeah. They effectively did a bailout. It's not the first time. It's happened before.
And they bought a crap load of yen to prop up the yen, yeah.
Because they bought a crap load of euros. Oh, sorry, no, yen. They didn't even use dollars.
Yeah, well, they traded them for euros.
Yeah. Not the first time it's happened, but it was a sharp intervention. That brings me back to a couple of things. Why Japan? Well, it's been the way it's been set up since 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Varoufakis described a global surplus recycling mechanism that was established after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And they deliberately rebuilt rebuilt Germany and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the dollar, key nodes in where the dollar system actually hit the road in terms of energy and stuffs. And excess surplus, because they were smart. They knew that it couldn't just all be centered on the U.S. because it would be the sole pillar, and there could be a collapse, a structural issue. And so they had these two other key pillars.
Yeah.
So that's partly what's going on there. The U.S. focus on Japan is a worry that what happens there is potentially a serious hit for the dollar. And I'm thinking that that's what they have in mind when they're trying to forestall Russian, Chinese, Iranian influence as well. It's not the stuffs per se and who gets it and stuff. It's how it's traded, because the serious over leverage of the debt the United States is in from the dollar being the reserve currency, because that's being eroded steadily.
Yeah. Well, it's about, like you mentioned, Japan is the number one holder of U.S. foreign treasuries, basically. And that's the way it's been for quite a long time. That was an agreement made, basically, where they're buying up a lot of American debt, basically, and holding a lot of American debt. UK second, actually, in the world. And they're in an equally bad state. And if their economies are tumbling, because, for example, pressure put on as a result of the situation with Iran, where Japan very dependent on foreign oil and gas and can't get enough of it, and therefore its economy falters and stumbles, whatever, then they're no longer able to service American or to buy up American debt. And you know, it's a spiral, basically. It's a feedback loop, you know. And America can't just keep producing paper money, fiat money out of thin air, because, you know, you get into an inflationary situation there, where you print way too much money that's not backed by anything tangible. You know what I mean? And to a large extent, the American dollar and the Fed's ability to keep printing money and giving it to the American government is backed by the perception of America as being able to service that debt because of its influence and control around the world, i.e. it's projecting its power around the world, being able to take terms, being able to get access to markets through implied threat of military force and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And this takes a big hit if America is seen to have failed in the Middle East.
Exactly.
But not only that, it seemed to have failed. It seemed to have lost, basically.
Yeah.
Which takes a big hit, and then
it's because America could no longer dictate monetary terms.
Right. America's reputation takes a hit. Just the feels of it basically means that people start to question the reliability of America as being able to effectively be the central pillar of the global economy. And that doesn't even take into consideration the actual physical reduction in oil and gas to these countries that are creditors, America's creditors, basically.
Yeah.
A lot of people talking about this could be ultimately the end of the US dollar hegemony as well. But like Russia and China have, in talking about multipolar world and all that kind of stuff, as they have been for the past years, have known this, have known that there's there can't be the unseating of America as a global hegemon and an institution of a multipolar world would invariably ultimately would have to lead to the unseating of the dollar as a reserve currency. And ironically, it's Trump's invasion and attack on Iran that seems
that
to
has
have
precipitated
been
precipitated or brought it forward,
bringing that. So it's almost you can blame Trump for basically wrecking the project for the new American century. You know what I mean? Except attacking Iran was probably a central pillar of, at least in their thinking, was a central pillar of that project for new American century. It was part of, you're going to have to take care of all these different countries, these seven countries in 5 years, as Wesley Clark mentioned. Iran was in there. But it was delusional, obviously.
Yeah.
It's proven to have been delusional. It was a nice idea on paper back in the day, 25 years ago, when they wrote it up and then they went about trying to make it happen. But apparently it was a bridge too far. It was especially in the context that they were trying to do it, which was other countries who weren't exactly inclined to support the idea of America continuing to be the global hegemon at the expense of others, particularly Russia and China and other countries, into the 21st century for another 100 years. Those countries are like, nah. So they're going to push back against it. And it's that pressure that was put on the Americans' attempt to institute that new American century that has led to it being somewhat delusional, proven to have been, you know, you can understand that they thought that it would have happened if it wasn't for those meddling kids. You know what I mean? If those kids hadn't come in and tried to mess things up, we would have our plan would have worked. But it's like, hang on, you're forgetting about the fact that they were always going to do that. You know, surely you factored in that they were always, but then, yeah, we did factor in that they were always going to push back against that. But we had plans as well to deal with their pushback against us. And the point is, we didn't know. We didn't know how it was going to play out. We actually had to wait and see. And oh yeah, it didn't work. But like, then you have to go back to square one and go, look, given that it has played out this way, if you had been more rational at the time, you would have been able to see that, yes, you could try it if you wanted, but the chances are that it's not going to work. Or you're going to break something in a big way and trying to make it, try and force it to work. But you're talking about reality creators at this point. This is around the same time that Karl Rove supposedly coined that term and claimed America, the Americans, these neoconservatives, whatever you want to call them, coming up with this plan for the new American century, they saw themselves as reality creators. So you can't get much more delusional than that, because at that point they're not fighting against, by definition, they're not just fighting against other countries, or because if they're just fighting against other countries, they can imagine themselves as, you know, maybe realistically enough, imagine themselves as prevailing eventually. But when they talk about reality creating, they're positing, they're putting themselves, confronting themselves of fighting,
godlike.
Well, fighting with reality.
Yeah,
it's in the word, in the term reality creators, right? That you, really.
It seems like a temptation that grew out of, well, through the Fed, we can regulate the entire financial system successfully for decades. Can we also regulate the oxygen levels, the land, who gets what? And full spectrum dominance. I mean, where does such a megalomaniac idea come from?
Right.
It's an extension of the exorbitant privilege they have enjoyed.
Yeah.
Now, as we often do, we hedge and we give them some, we extend to the Yankees, whether they're the more MAGA, relatively realist types, or your deep state or reality grader types, we extend some sanity to them, right? So let's do this here. Marco Rubio, on his way to China, said on Air Force One, look, we recognize that China's rising, but they've another thing coming if they think they're going to rise at our expense. Again, that's an either or. Obviously, the Americans don't want an either or where we fall flat in our face and all $37 trillion come home. We're fucked. But that also speaks to, that would be in China's interest to not have that happen either.
Mm-hmm.
Philip Pilkington writes that the Trump administration can either oversee a managed decline of dollar hegemony, or it can allow dollar hegemony to unwind chaotically. Mm-hmm. Now, unwinding chaotically is in no one's interest.
Mm.
I don't even think the Russians or the Iranians, they might talk hot at the moment, but I don't think it's in anyone's, because the whole system is based on it. So,
but then you get back to Xi's comment about the Thucydides trap. It's obviously forefront of their mind and has been for a long time. When Trump went over to meet him, and he said, "We hope," in his little speech, when Trump was there, he said, "We hope it remains to be seen, and we will have to hope that we'll not fall into the Thucydides trap," which is basically the idea of
the rising power,
well, the dominant power reacting badly,
kicking down at the rising,
reacting badly to the rising power, that it can be managed. But of course, it can be managed in theory. But if there isn't the will to do it, you know what I mean? If like I said, it's like the Americans see any tightening of their belt as intolerable. And not only just because, for ideological reasons, because we're number one, baby, and we should always be number one on principle, but rather that if they look at it, or maybe someone's given them dodgy intel on it, or how it would play out or whatever, but that they become convinced that there is no way for there to be a managed de-dollarization or a removal of the US as a global hegemon, that any attempt to do so would ultimately be fatal for America. Depends what you mean by fatal as well, right? I mean, it's just, is it fatal for a person in a mansion to have to move in to a bungalow? Is that fatal?
No.
Technically, no.
No.
But
it's such a shock to the.
It would be difficult. It would be painful.
Airs and graces.
There'd be a lot of.
They might have an apoplexy and a heart attack and kill over.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not. You can't just be completely rational about it in that sense. You know what I mean? Because you have to factor in ideology and self belief and the idea of the American mythos and the exceptional nation and all that kind of stuff. And it's hard for. You can't just say, that's silly. Why don't you just get rid of it? Why don't you stop thinking of yourself as this? Well, you've been thinking of yourself as an exceptional nation for a couple of hundred years, well, at least 100 years. Why don't you just give that up?
At the beginning of Trump's term, Scott Bessent, the financial wizard, or so he likes to, you to think.
The gay financial wizard.
Yeah, I know. He's quite a character. He mentioned Bretton Woods and a realignment of the financial order. Now, it was in the, it was dressed up in MAGA, 100%. But okay, just in the bare notes of history, you've got World War II. It lasts 5 years. It's intense. I mean, what we've lived through now isn't comparable for many reasons, but there are similar echoes. Bretton Woods came out of it. We've just gone through, it's four fucking years of Ukraine as a hot proxy war and really seriously threatening to be enlarged. But it's really 12 years if you go back to 2014, right? Because it went cold because Putin put a lid on it temporarily for a decade. Since 2023, we've got Iran. That's as hot possibly a war as you could have. It's so damn hot. It only lasted first 12 days and then really 4 weeks. That's how hot it is potentially. And so a lid's been put back on it for now. But and the lid is because of the structural limitations, I would argue. They might ideologically wish, just Trump wakes up one day, let's fucking nuke them. He might ideologically wish that, but he's still confronted with the reality of what's going to happen. And that's why nothing changes in the status quo we've been in since early April. Because you can't. And so they can each grind, each sides, if they're broad alliances, can keep grinding each other like this, this Saudi Turkish, Pakistani pact. If you look at the map, and Iran's like, fuck you. It's obviously geared at us because we're in the middle of it. But it's an adaptation. I think where this is heading to, I don't think, absent real madmen making a mad decision and just saying, let's just see it unwind chaotically and see what happens. Maybe we'll come out on top. Mm-hmm. I think prosaically, a prosaic thing is that there's going to have to be a big conference or something. And it won't be peace over Iran per se, like I was suggesting last week, but even broader still. Like, what are we going to do with this debt bomb, which is sitting under all of us? Russia may be economically healthy in its within its own numbers, but it also understands, like China, the blowback from the $37 trillion debt bomb is nuclear for everyone. Mm. So there would have to be, prosaically, where this frozen conflict would lead to is another kind of Bretton Woods. If you go back to Bretton Woods, the arrangement that they discussed and almost signed until really the last day was not that the dollar per se would be the global reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
John Maynard Keynes came up with Bancor. It's just a fictitious term. What it is, it's a fictitious currency that's never actually used, but it's shuttled between all the central banks of the world, so that whenever one country has a trade imbalance with another, Bancor settles the difference,
mm-hmm.
and then the country is obliged from this genuinely multilateral global system to adapt its industries. So if it's too heavy in one, it has to tamp it down and develop in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that it would really genuinely regulate. At the last minute, the Americans, Harry Dexter White says, nah, fuck that. You Brits, you lost to us.
Mm-hmm.
You owe us so much from Lend-Lease. Now, it's kind of like in Lord of the Rings, you know. Why should I give it away?
Yeah.
My precious. Mm-hmm. Why should I? And they went at the last minute and they kept it.
Mm-hmm.
But that power now, 80 years later, I'm thinking actually has to be globally
shared
in formal ways. And I've said it on the shows. It crossed my mind that when Trump went tariff mania last April, and I know it's, he went up 250% and he came down here and he made exemptions and it looked mental and chaotic. But what he had in mind was the specific sets of trade imbalances he had with mm-hmm. different countries and rebalancing them.
Mm-hmm.
Bancor, in the original Bretton Woods idea, was going to do that. And the Americans went, nah, we'll just use the dollar. So we may have to return to that.
Mm-hmm.
We being the collective we, because the alternative is chaos. It's bedlam, as Trump said 4 weeks ago. And they know it's bedlam because he said as much.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see them going, fuck it. Let's throw caution to the wind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll have to wait and see. We can revisit this topic. I mean, we'll probably revisit it before then, but like you jump ahead 6 months or something like that to the end of the year or into early next year. And the real thing that's looming right now in a certain sense is the kind of potential structural effects of this shutdown, partial shutdown, whatever, over the last few months of the Strait of Hormuz, and how that is if and how that is going to come home to roost, basically. Because, you know, I mean, it's probably more complicated than the whole system, as we've said on a few occasions. The whole system is a lot more robust than people think, and there's a lot of people on social media saying, predicting the collapse of this and that and the other. But I think things don't collapse that easily, you know what I mean? It is a very robust system. Generally speaking, and it would take something very significant for the whole thing to just come crashing down. But and it's not something that hasn't happened to the scale that people are imagining it would happen. That hasn't happened. You're talking about something obviously very different and probably a lot worse than the depression in the US, kind of global depression, but the Great Depression in the 1930s, you know,
yeah.
Very different world we live in today, a lot more people, a lot more integrated and all that kind of stuff. So this is totally uncharted territory, and, mm-hmm. and where it actually goes is relatively unknown, but at least we can say that if the energy spigots have been, you know, curtailed to some extent, that has to have some kind of a, if it continues on. I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows. Again, it's something that hasn't happened before, so nobody knows how it plays out. This has been experienced and seen for the very first time by everybody.
Mm.
They're experimenting with the idea like recklessly experimenting with the idea of what happens if you shut off 20% of the world's oil and gas? What would happen? I mean, would we be able to like share it around and find new sources, whatever, or you know, share the 80% in order to prevent the global economy from really collapsing? You know, could we survive on 80% basically? And nobody knows. And there's lots of people imagining or thinking about what would happen, but literally no one knows. But what you can say is that the chances of it having pretty negative real world effects increase as the time increases.
Yeah.
That you have this situation where the Strait of Hormuz is that oil and gas is restricted coming out of that major production area.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And people,
nobody knows.
Nobody knows. I mentioned European air travel as a whole is at record numbers. The Germans put out some data this week as well. Yeah, more flights took off from German airports than mm-hmm. at any time ever. Like, mm-hmm. people, they're certainly not prepared for it. But again, we know that the powers that be, at least at the official government levels anyway, have in the past taken into mind, okay, this action we're about to do is possibly going to shock the general population, so let's prepare them. So when Ukraine kicked off in February 2022, mm-hmm. especially the German government, but across Europe, there was a big campaign to prepare people psychologically for the fact that you could well be having cold showers and etc., among other things. And German fucking TV ads saying, you know, you could heat up your living room if you use tea candles mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in garden pots. So we know it's on their mind, but at the moment, they're not preparing.
The evidence that it was on Trump's mind and the Americans' mind in general is Venezuela, right? They went in, mm-hmm. they didn't, can't be divorced or from the situation in Iran, because it was only a couple of months later that they went for Iran. So obviously that was part of a whole, right? It was hedging the bets by going and grabbing Venezuela's oil in order to hedge against what he was planning to do at that point in time, which hadn't announced it yet, but what he was planning to do, which was attack Iran and the potential. So it was obviously a consideration that by attacking Iran, we could create a global energy crisis. And in order to insulate ourselves, America, against that, we're going to take Venezuela as well. So it's obviously something it's a real consideration, obviously. Mm. It's not something you can just dismiss and say, it doesn't matter, you know, Strait of Hormuz shut down for a while, it's not a big deal. Obviously, they thought it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And like you just said, Trump said that if he were to go full hog on Iran, that would cause bedlam. It wouldn't cause bedlam in itself. Iran's response is what would cause bedlam, but Trump would be blamed for it. But then you get back to Israel and whether or not Israel sees a vested an interest for them that it's something that faced with the idea of America basically being seen to have been defeated in the Middle East and just leaving and taking their ships and going home, and the negative implications of that for America's presence in the Middle East, and therefore the negative implications that probably would have for Israel's security in the Middle East, that Israel would on balance just say, look, it's better if we go ahead and attack Iran in the knowledge that they will respond by destroying the energy resources in the Middle East and throw the world into economic chaos, that is actually better for Israel than the alternative, which is America sailing home and with its tail between its legs. Because the outcome of that they would game out is, in their minds, would look very bad. So it's a rational decision, you know, in their mind. Even though it's completely irrational, it's a rational decision.
It's completely insane.
But then you could say
shall rule all over all the nations, just like Yahweh promised.
But if that kind of thing happens, if the whole thing goes, if it's a chaotic kind of crash of the global economy and all that kind of stuff, then that's definitely something that the Americans have gamed out when they planned for, when they looked at this whole potential or burgeoning multipolar world, Russia and China, and America being unseated as a global hegemon. They definitely, like, can it be managed or can it be chaotic? Well, they've definitely looked at that themselves and gamed that out themselves. And maybe the Americans figured that, look, it's probably better if we just let the whole thing go to hell. You know, it'll be kind of managed hell to some extent, but we're well positioned. We have a lot of our own natural oil and gas. We just took Venezuela's. We still have our military, and we're, you know, pulled our horns in to some extent from the rest of the world. We're insulating ourselves from the rest of the world in order to brace for impact, because we'd be much better positioned to restructure or to fight for a place or to gain a place in a new world order, in a new world after some kind of an economic crisis slash collapse slash whatever. That scenario, we're better positioned to actually rise again to the top, let's say, after a certain period of time, after that happens, than dealing with this managed, you know, it's like, the Americans said is like, what, so managed de-dollarization or managed multipolarity or something, managed unseating of America.
All they hear is communism.
No, all they hear is managed suicide. Like, you want me to manage my walk up the gallows and put the rope around my neck, manage the rope gently around my neck and then in a managed way pull the fucking trapdoor? Is that what you're talking about? I'll manage my own suicide. There's probably a lot of them thinking that
well,
way.
Well, the polite term is euthanasia.
Yeah. Yeah, let me manage my euthanasia. So it just depends on which school of thought prevails, you know?
Yeah.
And Trump isn't the person to... He's not the decider.
He's not the decider in chief,
right?
No.
He's just going along with it. He's like most other presidents, he's ended up being just the front man, right? As much as he tried to be the actual POTUS and exercise the powers of the office of the president and all that kind of stuff. As it is now, he has basically just fallen back into the, and he's realizing that he probably always was, despite his efforts to do otherwise. He has just been the steward of Gondor. He's
fallen in the same way, in the broad strokes.
Yeah, in the same way as all other presidents, where they're just the front men. Someone else is pulling the strings behind the scenes. And yeah. Trump fought that and finally realized that he had no choice, that he doesn't actually have all the cards. He doesn't have the cards to be able to impose his will on the unelected career bureaucrat / deep staters who actually run the country and have done for a very long time. They're not giving up their influence to someone like Trump, you know. They had to fight him for it, but they're always going to win. And Trump has realized that. So now he's trying to bullshit. All you're getting now, and what you will get from Trump for the rest of his term, is Trump talking increasing amounts of bullshit to make it look like he's still the commander-in-chief, despite the mounting evidence that he's not, and never has been. And that'll get worse and worse, you know what I mean? If you're maddened by his flip-flopping and bullshitting and saying one thing one day and another thing the next, that's just going to get worse, you know, as he cedes more and more power, as he realizes that he really doesn't have, there's no point in him trying anymore to actually exert his influence or his will. He'll revert to, like, you know, epoxying reflecting pools or carving his face on Mount Rushmore or something like that.
Taking a personal interest in the new Arc de Triomphe to be built. Yeah. I want it 1 foot taller than Paris's.
Yeah.
It's got to be bigger.
Right. So, yeah. I think that's how it goes, to be honest. And Israel is obviously just... Who knows what Israel's going to do? I mean, the main thing for me, Israel is somebody, I mean, it's unlikely to happen, but someone needs to stop them from continuing to slaughter Palestinians. They're a bunch of animals, you know. The Israelis that are behind that, they just continue to do it every day, you know, killing women and children. The world looks away. Of course, the world looked away for the past 3 years when they've been 4 years.
Three years now.
Since they've been literally committing genocide in Gaza. You know, we're probably talking at least 1 million people, 70-80% of them, women and children. So, yeah, it's not a good look, you know. There's not a lot of not to be said for global, the global leader, the global leadership, you know. Either the ones that could have done something about that who didn't are a bunch of psychos just like the Israelis and they don't care about slaughter, or they have no power to do anything about it, which again posits some kind of a other
infrastructure
behind the scenes, you know. You have to do that. Eventually, as things get worse and worse, you have to start pointing more and more to some other hidden hand that has been, that directs things, you know, and it's increasingly directing things as their plans, whatever, come to fruition, you know. They have to have more, but the hand has to be placed on the board more often. Previously, it was like a little bit here, a little bit there, but let the other stuff let the politicians take care of it, you know, or behind doors meetings or that kind of influence. But as things get worse and worse, and
they have to show their hand. They will inevitably show their hand.
Yeah, but still through the politicians. But as they do that, the overt politicians start to look less and less like they have any influence or control. And they have to make up more and more lies, more and more bullshit to try and justify why they're doing something that no one agrees with. Really, why are you doing stuff that no one agrees with? That even you, in private...
Yeah, 10 months ago. You're on tape. 2 weeks ago, you're on tape saying the opposite.
Saying the opposite, but now you're going ahead and doing it. So who's actually calling the shots here, you know? So that's a big reveal, like, in a certain sense. But it's only for people with eyes to see, you know. And it's a hard one for people to, because it still remains hidden. But it's a hard one for people to accept, you know.
Yeah, it still remains hidden. Yet it's so ubiquitous.
Yeah,
and so they're like, you're asking me to believe they're all in on the conspiracy. It's too vast. It's too vast. Can you put that up? What about this? Can this work?
No.
No.
Except as a certain kind of guiding light or principle stance type thing that people could pay attention to. It's just stuff like Tucker Carlson and the others there are just voices in the wilderness in a certain sense that people can look to and for a voice of sanity. But they're not gonna be a party of sanity like in America, you know.
Okay. So no true MAGA party redux. Even if it did come about, they'd enter the same, they'd encounter the same problems Trump did.
Yeah, kind of exploding megaphones and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my feeling on it too. I'm too cynical. Trump was the genuine last attempt at a...
Mm-hmm.
At a resistance, at least politically. But mind you, I saw a couple of some of Tucker's monologues this week, and I think it's like you said before. He knows better because he actually said, not that I think there's any political solution to any of this, mm-hmm. but people are interpreting this meeting with these other rebels as him. Tucker launching a bid to become president. But he's on record saying that. Politically, I don't think there's a solution. So, but anyway, what he was saying, the meat of his monologue this week, it's titled, It's Time to Save America. The media reported it as him laying out a manifesto, but I don't know if you can call that, because he gave 10 characteristics that he believes America should be. And so he's talking about 10 values. That's not a party political manifesto, but...
No.
America should be fair, sovereign, productive, beautiful, healthy, honest, optimistic, wise, decent, united. And he elaborated in what he meant by those. Of course, yeah, awesome. A country of sane humans...
Yeah,
99% would all agree with that.
Yeah, it's an idea that that should be put out there and for people to hold on to, and the increasing bullshit that they're subjected to by the powers that be and stuff. But you're talking about people who run the show, basically, whatever you want to call them, deep staters, whatever, behind the scenes bureaucrats, and the intel agencies, etc. Their MO is that whenever there's something that threatens their agenda, to keep control of people and keep pushing people, a population in a certain direction. If there's a threat against them doing that, and it's significant enough, they just kill the person. And they do it in a way where people talk and everybody knows that it was quote unquote them that did it, or whatever. That's what they have. That's what they've got. So like, imagine they formed a party or whatever, mm-hmm. and then somebody says, take out Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
And a wink and a nod, and the rest of them all know. What are they going to do? They're all going to stand up and say, I'm Spartacus, and you know, sacrifice themselves as well. Maybe. Some noble people do, but the problem is, that it's sad, but that kind of thing has to happen. You know, the Charlie Kirk thing has to happen in order to try and wake people up. The people who do that, who kill Charlie Kirk and kill many other people, going back to JFK and before, that's their only recourse to a threat to their power. It's a very blunt instrument. It's sad. You know, they can't win. It's like, you can't win. It's like taking that gun to a football match and when you're 2-0 down, you start shooting the other players.
You pull out the red card and say, hang on, the rules. And they go, what rules? Bang, they shoot the referee.
Yeah, exactly. And but the problem is that as they do that, they expose the fact that that's what they do, and they expose the reality of their existence and of their and how they operate. So it's they're diminishing returns basically for those kind of people, because the more you want, like I was saying earlier on at the start of the show, when the more you want to exert control and influence, you know, control a population to finer and finer orders, you have to be, you can do it subtly at the beginning, but then the more, but you have to increase, you know, because people get used to, you know, because you have an end goal. You want complete control. So you have to institute the controls bit by bit by bit. But each one reduces the freedoms of people more and more and more, because it's heading towards complete control of them. So the more you reduce people's freedom, the more likely it is that they're going to start realizing that their freedoms are being taken away and who's doing it. Because you have to be more overt and use a blunt, more blunt, an increasingly blunt instrument to exert your control. It would be nice if you could just control people just by whispering to them quietly in their ear at night and just do that forever.
Or using AI, rely on that 100%. Yeah,
or whatever. But it's a contradiction in terms, you know. You can't continue to take control, control people and take their freedoms away, and also have the same people believe that A, it's for their own good, and B, it's actually making them freer, or that it's a positive thing. Like, do negative things against people and try and convince them that it's good. What do you have to do to people to get them to believe that? Lobotomize them? Just lobotomize everybody. But then that's no good, because then it's just a bunch of like drooling nincompoops as your slaves. And they can't even function properly as slaves because you've just lobotomized them all. People who follow that path are just nuts. Like, they haven't even thought it through, you know?
Yeah, the end goal is unreachable.
Yeah.
By definition.
Yeah. But for the people who are subjected to it, it's definitely a trial by fire, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of people, you know, obviously fall by the wayside and get, you know, it doesn't work. You know, they don't survive, especially depending on because the type of controls we're talking about here, we've been positing even, is that they may be planning on some kind of global economic crash or something, you know, behind the scenes, orchestrating something out of this Strait of Hormuz business where they do actually cause a major global economic crash with all the...
And don't mind it, because they have,
And with all the associated problems of food supply and energy supply, you know, so lights out, no showers, you know, candles, tea light candles and gruel, you know, so.
They better be, when people go hungry.
Yeah.
Is when you got a revolution on your hands, so unless you're going to control that revolution.
Well, yes, what do you do? You plan to control the revolution. You say, okay.
It's like trying to control a wildfire.
Are you experiencing some problems? We have some solutions.
Hmm.
And that's where the aliens come in, because they're the they're the highest order, right? They're the final boss, and they're the ones who can come in as a new.
They better come in as beautiful 12-foot Nordics.
Though. Well, they will, because it's, you know, you always say you want some fresh faces. People get tired of the old guard because they've been mismanaging the thing. And look at those politicians we have today. They create an economic crisis. The whole world's gone to hell. There's no food. There's no electricity. I'm having to use tea lights to freaking heat my water and keep myself warm and stuff. They're all no good. We've tried them over and over again, and none of this old guard are any good. All of them, to man, they're useless. What we need is some new fresh faces around here. A real breath of fresh air. Maybe something from outer space or underground or wherever. Something new, different
from the future.
Someone from the future, from the past, wherever. I don't know. Anything other than this shower of bollocks that we've had for decades now.
If I see one more smooth talking politician. So they have to be brought to that point where they're no longer foolable by politicians.
Right.
No matter who it is.
Yeah, and then clamour for somebody. It has to, the conditions have to be bad enough for someone to come in and save them. And if there's anything,
they're praying for Jesus.
If there's anything to this whole UFO business, whatever, the disclosure, all that kind of stuff that the Pentagon's been talking about releasing bits and pieces. If there's anything to that, those people, whatever that manifests or comes out as, that would be a perfect candidate for the new fresh faces to come in and solve all our problems created by these old shower of arseholes. Meet the new boss.
Meet the new boss, definitely not appearing the same as the old boss.
No, well, they have to be good looking.
That's the ultimate conspiracy.
A load of Obamas. No, Obama, we did Obama.
No, hope and change, done. Leftism, done. Now MAGA's done.
Yeah.
That's the time that Trump, the Iranians have Trump. It's almost like they're like willfully trying to wreck his legacy. If you could posit that's, I mean, they have other things to think about the Iranians, but the effect of them biting down hard on Hormuz is Trump and MAGA are cooked, absent some changes happening between now and 2028.
For new gods to be brought in, you have to destroy all your old gods have to be thrown to the ground. Right. You have to try them all, and none of them worked. So can we have some real gods? Ones with superpowers and stuff, like Superman. Where are you, Superman? As Homer Simpson said, I'm not a religious man. I don't pray. But if you're up there, please help me, Superman.
Simpsons was awesome. That's pretty much what people are like. Maybe they were already like that in the 90s, hence they could lampoon it.
Mm. Yeah, so that's where we're at, basically. And there's all sorts of talk going on, people discussing it and prognosticating and crystal balling what's going to happen, all that kind of stuff. And the truth is that we don't actually know. But, like we said, all of the evidence, to put it all together, suggests that there would be a real missed opportunity to create some kind of a economic crisis out of this Tehran business, out of this Iran business, the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe they'll back off on it, and like you said, they'll work out something and create a new Bretton Woods system or something like that. But I can't see the American, as they are now, I can't see the Americans saying no to that, you know. Especially if Trump has to sign on it and stuff, and the influence being put on him, and if the influence comes from the Israelis are just, they're crazy people. Like,
they may as well be aliens.
Yeah, they're this wild card. You know, they literally are a wild card, and they don't have any skin in the game. Like, they'll be the last ones to sign up to Bretton Woods, to that kind of thing, because it's like, you know, they're the people who walk alone, right? They're the perennial victims, and they're dissociated from the rest of humanity. So and whatever's good for the rest of humanity, generally speaking, isn't good for at least in the Jewish kind of Zionist especially mindset, those two things are chalk and cheese. You know, it's what's good for Israel. Usually when you know what's good for Israel, when nobody else in the world likes it. Right? Nobody likes genocide, but it's good for Israel.
Jesus. Save us, Superman.
Come down, Superman, save us.
Yeah. I mean, as long as this isn't biting yet and we're not feeling it yet. Ah, shit. Even when it does bite, we'll have no choice but to be philosophical about it. I suppose the not knowing for many months there was eating at me. Like, that's what, it was what impels you to just to watch it every day, which way is this going, you know, and try and predict and prognosticate. But after several months now, it's like,
yeah,
you just have to accept the not knowing. It's kind of a...
Just pay attention.
Castaneda said you have to just, you know, stare into the unknown with...
Well, it's a fine, it's a kind of difficult line to walk where you have to, you still have to pay attention to it all, but not get invested in imagining that from what you're trying to predict necessarily fixed outcomes from what you're looking at. So you do have to keep paying attention to it, because it's only after the fact that you'll find out. You look back and you'll be able to say, oh, that's how this all happened. And whether it was just a confluence of different factors or whatever, it was planned or whatever, you might be able to figure that out after the fact. But in order to be able to understand it retrospectively, you have to have watched all the details all along the way to be able to put it together, you know what I mean? Because otherwise, if it all comes crashing down and then there's something comes out of that afterwards and you look back and you see, you have, the more you watched it all the way, the better picture you're able to form of it retrospectively and understand how it happened. People haven't been paying attention. They only wake up, the only information they get as a general rule is whenever things get real, when shit just got real.
Yeah.
But then they don't have anything enough information to inform, you know, to explain why it, to see, understand how and why and put the picture together, like I said, after the fact, you know. For them, it's just like, one day it was all fine, the next day it was all shit.
Yeah, one day it was all fine, the next day I've got a turbo cancer, Putin's evil, and God bless Fauci.
Yeah.
And, and somehow that's consistent and coherent to them.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've prognosticated enough. What's going on in there?
We've got, let's see.
The question may also be what those overlords pulling the strings of Israel have as plans for Israel, and perhaps how those forces, overlords behind Iran will respond. There's forces and overlords behind Iran? Maybe.
That's where it gets complicated, huh?
Yeah, well, that's... Don't know about that. I think it's, you know, the way Iran may be helped would by staying the hand of America. You don't necessarily have to help Iran directly. I mean, China and Russia can help Iran directly. That's a lot of help in terms of targeting and all that kind of stuff, to make their military capabilities more effective. But you can help
by not doing,
using my football analogy, you can, you know, force one team to play football in their socks, as opposed to don't give them any boots, basically.
Yeah.
And then the other team gets an advantage by definition, you know. So, manage to claim controlled or more uncontrolled chaos. Maybe the powers that be work with the premise that whatever happens, they can always make. What's the rest of that? Can't see the rest of it.
Which one?
The bottom one. What's the rest of it? Why is it cut off? Controlled or more uncontrolled chaos starts with.
Yes. Maybe the powers that be work with the premise that whatever happens, they can always make a controlled chaos. Chaos. But is that hubris? That's the thing. It seems as if they're stress testing the system. Cautiously, they believe, because they're like, because we know they've been more cautious in the past than they're being now, but they see that things are still, the oil's still flowing. There hasn't been a big hit on the European market, for example. Yes, gas prices are going up, but nothing catastrophic yet. So they're going, well, there's still some room in this system, so keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a threshold or something, or orders come down in some way we can't see. to not intervene as you might normally, like say Scott Bessent did with with the yen last week.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, oh, shit, it just happened organically.
Yeah.
But it's just because somebody maybe did not do something.
Took the hand off the lever, yeah.
It's the issue with the nuclear apocalypse. For them, it's always, when they believe that nuclear apocalypse is super possible / imminent, what exercises them is that, what if somebody makes a mistake? What if we send a signal and Moscow misinterprets it and then a nuke is fired? Because they really believe the world works like that, through mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't.
No. There does seem to be some kind of a controlling hand pushing this whole thing in a certain direction. It's very hard to determine or discern. You can't, basically. You can only infer its existence by looking closely at the broad dynamics and also the specifics, and you realize that, like we're saying, that these people, the so-called politicians, at the very least you can say this, the politicians that everybody think run the world, obviously don't. Yeah. You know, and that's increasingly clear in the statements they make and the actions and the policies they implement. They don't actually decide, because they're not doing anything that's in the best interest of them, of themselves even, and their own people, you know.
And they're going 180 on what they promised when they were just elected.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I think we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
We've done enough. It's almost a couple hours, so we'll leave it there for this week, folks. Yeah. Thanks for watching, listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with another one on whatever, as I keep saying, bullshit's been going on between now and then. So until then, have a good week. See ya.
Bye, all. Thanks for listening.
Can't stop the signal now.